Jonathan Karl is ABC News' chief Washington correspondent and chief White House correspondent. His new book is Front Row at the Trump Show. Karl has known and covered Donald Trump longer than any other White House reporter. With extraordinary access to Trump during the campaign and at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, he delivers essential new reporting and surprising insights. This is the real story of Trump's unlikely rise, of the struggles and battles of those who work in the administration and those who report on it. He shows us an administration rewriting the role of the president on the fly at a press corps that has never been more vital. Again, the name of the new book is Front Row at the Trump Show, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jonathan Karl to the roundtable this morning. How are you, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on. I'm a great admirer of your work, and I can't tell you how much, you know, this book I would have loved at any time, but given what we're living through now, this has just been the oasis. I mean, this is the best to read. Give me a sense of why you wanted to write it while you were in the midst of it.
Well, I realized I had seen history in a way that I don't think any other White House reporter has ever seen it. I had this relationship with Donald Trump, first meeting him nearly 26 years ago. And the stuff that I had seen and experienced directly with him and the people who work with him over the past 5 years, since the beginning, really even before he announced his run for president, I just realized I needed to get this out because I felt that it was unique insight that would help people understand the way Trump operates and the way things work in a White House that is unlike any other White House that this country has ever seen. So it was a challenge knowing when to write it. I considered writing it right after the campaign. I considered writing it, several other times before I finally did, mostly limited by time and the crush of the news. But I've got to tell you, seeing how this came out now, and you never know, it was hard to stop writing. It was hard to hit send and get it off to the publisher and know that I wouldn't be able to write anymore. But the timing is oddly perfect, because the crisis that we are now in and the way we are now seeing Trump, I think you can really understand his approach and the behaviors we're seeing by reading this story.
So let's talk about that for a moment. The president that we are seeing nightly during the White House coronavirus briefings, no surprise to you, as to a person who has covered, I don't think there's probably a surprise to many Americans who are watching nightly, but for you who are actually in that room, no surprises.
No, I think that, first of all, the one thing that you would think would be a surprise is the mere fact that he is in that room, because he, for the first 3 years of his administration, barely set foot in the briefing room. As a matter of fact, for the first 2 years, the only time he even opened the door and peered inside, didn't actually step inside, was the night that he announced that he was going to be doing direct talks with Kim Jong-un. I write about this crazy experience I had with him that night. He opened the door. He said, there's going to be a big announcement at 7 o'clock. And then there was this crush of people to the door, and he went off. And he never came back in that room until sometime last year, when he came at the very beginning of a press conference with some other officials and walked out without taking any questions. But other than that, this is a place that was alien to him. And the crisis hits, and his task force is set up with Pence, and he decides to come out at one point and be with Pence as they are doing a task force briefing. And I think it just dawned on the president that, wow, I get to be here in front of this nice podium, all these people looking at me, all my powerful administration officials surrounding me, and loved it. Now, it doesn't surprise me that he loved it, but it was the first time that he had done it. And now he does these things daily, including Saturday and Sunday, and sometimes they go on. Last night's went on for over 2 hours with the president. Really unbelievable.
One of the things that comes through, and you tell the story in the book, from your earliest dealings with him, I mean, you had early dealings with him as a print reporter, but as a television reporter, one of the first things he said to you is, well, okay, this is how the interview went, but you got great ratings. And that's what he's crowing about now. I mean, after all of these decades, is still, you're going to watch me every night, and the ratings are great.
And that is the single most predictable thing about this crisis. It would be the most bizarre thing for any other public figure, but for Trump, it's like, of course he's looking to see how many people are watching him. And he saw the New York Times, which he vilifies on a daily basis, mentioned that more people are watching the briefings than watch the season finale of The Bachelor. That is speaking Trump's language. He's tweeting about it. Now, how odd is it? The country is facing the biggest crisis that you or I have ever seen. We are getting to a point where hundreds, maybe soon thousands of Americans are dying every day, and he's crowing about the ratings.
Mm.
It's incredibly abnormal, but for Trump, it's entirely predictable.
I know what's happening in our newsroom and in my living room when I'm watching it. I'm just wondering how many times are you just so calloused to it that you don't wince, you don't roll your eyes, you just stare ahead.
Well, you've got to have a good poker face when you're doing this stuff. You know, you're there in the front row, the cameras can be on you, and he says something that just kind of like you're like, oh my God, you can't really let that show. Sometimes I probably do. but you really can't. And what I try to focus on is the stuff that matters to the people watching at home. I mean, we are in this incredibly perilous and frightening moment, and there is important information to be had at these briefings. Sometimes the information from the president, very important. Sometimes it's not accurate. Sometimes it's oddly off tune, kind of off. But the bottom line is we go there, we want to know what is happening, what is the federal government doing to deal with this crisis, what should they be doing to deal with this crisis, what should we be doing in our personal lives to keep ourselves and our families and our friends safe. And that's the information that I try to focus on when I go into these briefings, not, you know, the kind of odd political statements that may come out every once in a while, or, you know, the very odd self-congratulations about how great everybody is doing. I mean, nobody really wants to hear that. I mean,
right.
Just tell us what is going on and what we should be doing and what we should be prepared for. So that's what I try to focus on. It's a different kind of experience than going into a typical presidential press conference. Nothing is typical about this time.
I've heard this debated two ways. One is whether the press should be covering these, which I believe they should. I don't know why they wouldn't. Of course they should. The other question, which we've had to deal with in our newsroom, is whether you carry them live for their duration, as you say, going on sometimes over 2 hours. And what is the responsibility then? Because this is a criticism that came back to the campaign. Obviously, he wasn't president then, but back to the campaign where you allow it to go unfettered and you see people responding. Obviously, now you're seeing ratings go up of poll numbers, his poll numbers going up. What is the responsibility of a network such as yours, such as NPR, to carry those live in full?
Well, first of all, I think that you have correctly pointed out that there are two questions here. Do you cover them and do you carry them live? Too often those get lumped together. I hear people saying, you guys should boycott the briefings. You shouldn't go. That's ridiculous. I mean, that's my job. I'm a White House reporter. I go there. I've got a chance to ask the president questions. I have the chance to ask the vice president, who's the head of his task force, the questions, the health experts. Of course I'm going to go there. Of course it's my responsibility. Of course I'm going to correct misstatements and inaccuracies, and of course I'm going to ask tough questions. You have to do it. Carrying it live is an entirely different question, and I think it's a legitimate debate. And I think that it is something that should be answered in individual newsrooms. And I think it's legitimate that some have said we can't just allow this to go unfiltered, because it becomes, like, in some cases it can be like a free political ad, because he goes into politics. I mean, he goes, you know, he starts praising Republican governors, attacking Democratic governors, kind of without any, you know, connection to what is actually happening on the ground regarding this crisis. He, you know, touts his own administration, and not just its handling of this, but he gets into all other, you know, he gets into all kinds of other political things on occasion, pretty much at every briefing at some point. And, you know, do you really need to carry that live? Probably not. But I think that some news organizations will continue to decide to carry it live, because there is an immediacy to the information. People want to know, and they want to know now, because it affects all of us. So I don't fault networks that have decided to go basically gavel to gavel and cover the entire thing live. I do think, though, if you decide to do that, and we have carried some of them live, and we rarely carry the whole thing live, and sometimes we don't carry any of it live. It kind of depends on what we can learn about what news is going to come out of the briefing. But the point is, if you are going to do that, carry it live, either in whole or in part, there's a responsibility to provide immediate context to what was said. And if there are, you know, misstatements, to correct those in real time. But I think it's a legitimate debate. Trust me, it's not an easy one either.
Jonathan Karl is our guest. He is the author of the new book, Front Row at the Trump Show. We should also mention, when it comes to this debate, that you are also president of the White House Correspondents Association. So this is something that, I mean, just one of many issues that your association is dealing with in the covering of this administration. You write in the introduction of the book, how do you report on a president who will look you in the eye and tell you something he knows is not true? How do you maintain standards of fairness and objectivity when reporting on somebody who has branded you a traitor to your own country? I'm still trying to figure that out. That is to me sort of one of the most startling things, is that I think you and many Americans are still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that, because I really do think, and I tried to be brutally honest with the readers of this book about the dilemmas that I have faced as a reporter in the Trump era, and the fact that I don't have all the answers here, but by any stretch. But to me, my instinct and what I believe in to my core as a professional journalist, that my aim is to provide objective, fair, balanced reporting, particularly on political issues. And every reporter has political views. Every reporter has political biases somewhere in there. I'm not immune to that. But what I believe is that those views and those biases must not affect my reporting. And I have to be equally aggressive and equally fair to the people that I cover. And it's hard in this White House when you see, you know, like in the passage that you just read, you know, I've had the president tell me point blank things that I know that are not true. And I don't answer that by saying you are a liar, why are you lying to me? It may be tempting to do that at times, but I think the word lie is a very weighted word. It implies an intentional deception, when sometimes it might be intentional, sometimes it might not be. But it's not for me to make that judgment. I think it's for the people that are reading or watching my stories to make the judgment. So I just say that was incorrect, that was not factual, here's the truth. But even just doing that over and over and over again, the cumulative effect for people watching can say, that guy, that reporter, he's just out to get the president. He's just opposed to everything the president says, and that's not the position I want to be in. So it's a challenging time, and we live in such deeply divided times where people not only have their own views on a given matter, but but seem to have their own set of facts and sense of what's real and what's not. And I, you know, it's tough. This is a challenging time to report on the White House. I think probably as challenging a time as we've ever seen.
You know, I want to go to a section in the book about opposition. It's called Opposition Party, and because you put your finger on this better than anyone I've ever heard talk about this, there's a situation, of course, where the president calls the press the enemy of the people. Then Ivanka Trump was asked about this, and she said, "No, I don't believe that the media is the enemy of the people. You bring us to a press briefing." And Sarah Huckabee Sanders is there and says that it's she says it's completely understandable for the president to be frustrated. Then we go to CNN's Jim Acosta, and you say he asks a question of Sanders, a follow-up question that made many of the reporters in the room, including me, uncomfortable. "I think it would be a good thing," Acosta said, "if you were to say right here at this briefing that the press, the people who are gathered in this room right now doing their jobs every day, asking questions of officials like the ones you brought forward earlier, are not the enemy of the people. I think we deserve that." You write, "Acosta was entirely correct that the White House press secretary should be able to say that the people she works with every day are not traitors or enemies, as the president has so often said. But by personalizing the issue the way he did, Acosta was missing the larger point. The enemy of the people slur is more than an attack on the reporters in the briefing room. This isn't about Jim Acosta or any of the individuals who cover the White House. A free and independent press is an essential component of American democracy. Frankly, who cares if the president insults us as individuals?" You just talked about, you know, how easy it can be to fall into that category. But how damaging is it to the press corps as a whole when reporters do fall into that?
I think it's really damaging, and I think that, you know, look, I respect Jim Acosta. I fought to defend Jim Acosta when the White House tried to revoke his credentials. But that really did make me uncomfortable because it was turning this into an us versus them situation, which starts with the president, doesn't start with Jim Acosta, but he took the bait, as many, many others have taken the bait, and then, you know, turns it into a fight between the president and the press, and that's exactly where he wants to be. That's why he calls us the opposition party. You know, he told Leslie Stahl, I mentioned this in the 2016. During the 2016 campaign, Leslie Stahl said, "Why do you do these attacks on the press? You know they're not true. You know you don't believe them." Mm. And he said, "Well, I do it because when you do a negative story on me, I don't want people to believe it." You know, he wants people to believe that when they read the New York Times, they're reading a press release from the Democratic National Committee. And we just can't play into that. And it's more than an individual reporter. It's more than Jim and some others. It's for much of the last 3 or so years, if you turn on cable news, 2 of the 3 main cable news channels, and you watch the coverage, you would just get a sense of, you might not have a criticism of each individual story. These are all good stories and a lot of good journalists, but the tone is overall relentlessly negative. Mm. And a sense of, "Oh my God, look what he did today. Can you believe this latest outrage? Oh my God, look at this. He did this. This is unbelievable." And after a while, you know, people kind of tune it out. Certainly, you're not going to reach the people that support him. You're not going to change any minds over there. And those that already think he's a threat to the Republic are just going to be saying, "Amen, amen, amen." But then you lose your ability to categorize things. I mean, the minor becomes the same as the major. I mean, I use the example, and I'm, you know, I reported on it myself, so I, you know, I'm guilty. You know, not guilty. I think legitimate story, but the story about Hurricane Dorian and the president saying it was going to go to Alabama,
right?
And the Weather Service saying no, it's not going to Alabama. I mean, you know, it was ridiculous that he was saying this, but it's like, okay, whatever. It dominated news for a week. And what I write in the book is, I mean, watching the news, the cable news, particularly on any given day during that period, you would have thought that he had just invaded Iraq for weapons of mass destruction that weren't there. You know, I mean, it was that level of outrage, and it wasn't that level of mistake.
For individuals in that room, and I was just watching the press briefing the other night, and Jim Acosta asked a question, and the president got upset, and then right after that, it was Yamiche Alcindor of PBS NewsHour asked a perfectly legitimate question, and was dressed down, as you've seen many of your colleagues, and I guess I'm interested in that of what it is of a question as simple as was done a few weeks ago of why should the what do you tell the American people who are hearing this news and are scared, and it's immediately thought to be a nasty question. Do you understand that the logic of what he accomplishes in doing that to not only the question, but the questioner?
Well, I think there are different cases, different things that are trigger points. You know, I asked him about ventilators and could he assure hospitals and governors they'd get the ventilators they need. And he popped off and he called me, said, "Don't be a cutie pie. You're being a wise guy." I think in that case, he was upset because there was a suggestion that he might be accountable for something. He is not somebody who likes to take responsibility for anything. I like to take credit for everything, responsibility for nothing. And that's just a fact about Donald Trump. And he's not alone in that, in people in political life, but he is a particularly a strong example of that. But sometimes it's because he knows that his base loves it when he pops off on reporters and loves it. And other times he just genuinely, you know, gets ticked off. I mean, Yamiche asked perfectly legitimate questions. You know, Peter Alexander was the one who asked about the what's your message to Americans that are scared. I think what set him off there is just earlier Peter was pointing out that the president had said overly optimistic things about the potential for drugs to treat coronavirus.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard to say what's going to cause him to pop off. And I don't think it's particularly strategic. I think it's gut, it's instinct.
Which is so much about who he is, right? It's
yeah.
It's all about the gut. I mean, you learned that very early in back in the 90s in covering him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he's, you know, the analogy he used back then was to the prize fighters. The prize fighters have a saying, you go with the punches.
Mm.
You know, you don't go into the ring with a strategy. Okay, I'm going to hit this one, then I'm going to go over here, then I'm going to do two lefts. No, you go with the punches and the fight evolves. That's the way he sees himself. That was the analogy he used to describe how he operated as a real estate developer, and it's clearly also as he operates as president.
I mean, you certainly have heard this, and so many people have said it over the critics of the president have said it over the years, which is, look, okay, we're doing all this stuff, but let's see what happens when a real crisis hits. What's going to happen with this guy when a real crisis hits? Well, here we are, and we're seeing it, and I just don't know. When is the time to debate that and discuss it and say, oh, dear, this is dangerous? Because we're hearing people say we have to do it right now or we have to sort of take care of people are dying. Let's deal with that first. Legitimate point, of course. Let's deal with that first. And then we'll worry about the other stuff.
Well, my approach has been first deal with the crises at hand as a reporter. I don't spend a lot of time asking the questions, well, back in February you did this and then you didn't do this. I think those are perfectly legitimate questions. And frankly, they're perfectly legitimate questions to be asking now. It's just that my feeling is that what people most want to hear, again, is what is the government doing? What should the government be doing? And what can I be doing to ensure, you know, my safety and the safety of my family and my friends and my neighbors? So that's what I've tried to focus on first and foremost. But look, we are in a campaign year, and I think that all of this is going to be perfectly legitimate fodder to debate and discuss going forward. And you are right. This was the question we always said, what would happen in the case of a crisis? There were many crises over the first 3 years of the Trump presidency, but almost all of them were crises that were created by Trump or the Trump White House itself. this is the first truly grave external crisis. And I tell you that when I, you know, you began this conversation about why did you do it now? Why did you write this book now? Why, you know, you could have waited, maybe you could have done it earlier. I mean, it's kind of, I did it basically when I could.
Mm-hmm.
And the timing is perfect because all that you see unfolding in terms of his relationship with the truth, his relationship with the press, his management style, the way the people around him operate, these are all the primary themes of my book as I tell the story of what it has been like to be part of this and to cover this. And you see it on vivid display now as he deals with this crisis. This is in bright technicolor all of the things that I described in this book. Even though I wrote this book, of course, I had no idea that we were going to be in the middle of something like this. But we see him, just one quick example, and I know we're just about out of time, but
yeah.
One quick example is the management style. I talk about, you know, he had Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, he goes into John Kelly, Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, and there's an arc to all of this where there are efforts to control Trump, there are efforts to manage him, to protect him from his most destructive impulses by these various chiefs of staff, and by the time you get to Mulvaney, he's basically given up on all of that, and he, you know, is basically an idea of let Trump do what Trump's going to do, and I'm just here to manage the staff and not even to attempt to steer the president. Well, this crisis hit at precisely the moment where Donald Trump literally did not have a chief of staff.
Mm-hmm.
He announced that acting chief Mulvaney was gone, and Mark Meadows would be coming in, and Mark Meadows, most people don't realize this, Mark Meadows was a member of Congress until Monday of this week.
Right.
He was not the chief of staff until, didn't actually formally become chief of staff until Tuesday of this week. So this has truly been the president without any guardrails, all, you know, his instincts. He's the chief of staff. He's the press secretary. He's the communications director. He's driving the ship. Now, he may listen to the experts and bring in the experts, but this is all Donald Trump.
Do you have any allusions to the fact that my final question, that if there is a change in administration come November, assuming that you continue to be White House correspondent, that your job fundamentally changes and becomes whatever normal was?
You know, I don't know if we'll ever snap back to complete normal, but I do believe that the pendulum will swing wildly back to a much more routine and predictable way. I mean, you know, it certainly can't get get any more so.
Jonathan, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book. I read it, but I also I listened to it on Audible, and you have the archival recordings in there, which are great, of going back into the archive of some of the old interviews, which is really fascinating as well. The name of the book is Front Row at the Trump Show, from Chief White House Correspondent for ABC News, Jonathan Karl. John, thanks so much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you for taking time to read the book and picking out, I think, some really kind of important passages and reading them. And thank you for mentioning the audiobook, because it was a real passion project. And I think it's a unique audiobook because it does have all this old sound that we took the time to go in and pull out. It's not just me reading, but it's me reading and throwing back to some of these really central moments in the book and hearing them as they played out in real time. So thank you, and I hope a lot of people get a chance to listen to that audiobook. But you know, first buy the book.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, do both. Jonathan Karl, a great pleasure. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Excellent. Be well. Again, the name of the book, Front Row at the Trump Show, by Jonathan Karl. It's published by Dutton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.